Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining us today. We will get started in just a couple minutes. Right, we'll go ahead and get started. Hello, everyone. My name is Paul Bierman. I'm the Director of Education and Events for SNEB. Welcome to today's Journal of Nutrition, Education, and Behavior Journal Club webinar, part of a series of 11 webinars with a focus on nutrition education programs and implications from the field. Special thank you to the SNEB Food and Nutrition Extension Education Division for helping select articles from the journal showcasing the work of cooperative extension nutrition educators. If you guys are hearing that feedback in the background, I apologize. I don't know what that is. As the official peer-reviewed journal of the Society for Nutrition Education and Behavior, JNEB advances nutrition education and behavior-related research, practice, and policy. Before we begin, I'd like to review a few pieces of information with you. A handout with today's presentation will be made available. We will take questions at the end of the presentation. Throughout the presentation, please type any questions you may have into the Q&A box, and they will be moderated out to our panelists. When the webinar ends today, you'll be prompted to complete a short survey. Please take a moment to complete this, as your feedback is greatly appreciated for future SNEB webinars. This webinar is being recorded and will be available free of charge to SNEB members under the webinar section of the website. Finally, watch for a follow-up email to be sent in the next few days, which will include a link to the recording for this session, the handouts, and your CEU certificate for your attendance today. I can now hand things over to our moderator, Dr. Kristen DiFilippo, Teaching Assistant Professor at the University of Illinois. Kristen?
Thank you. Today I get to introduce our speakers who are sharing with us about teaching teachers how to integrate food science-based learning into preschool science. First, we have Dr. Virginia Stage, a registered dietitian, nutrition education and behavior specialist, and assistant professor in the Department of Agriculture and Human Sciences at NC State University. From the kitchen to the classroom, Dr. Stage's mission is to empower early childhood teachers and families with evidence-based strategies to improve children's dietary quality through early education, exposure, and access to healthy foods. Over the years, she has worked with 300-plus P-8 teachers nationwide on how to improve food and nutrition learning environments in school settings using qualitative and quantitative research methodologies. She also has experience writing and developing integrative nutrition education curricular resources and collaborating with P-8 upper-level administrative teachers and students. Jocelyn Dixon is the Assistant Director of the PEAS program in the Department of Agricultural and Human Sciences at North Carolina State University. Jocelyn has worked with the Feed Lab since 2016 and PEAS since its beginning. Her expertise is in qualitative and quantitative data collection and analysis, team and project management, stakeholder engagement, research quality control, training, and educational resource development. Jocelyn is a registered dietitian and licensed dietitian in North Carolina. Arcana Hedge is an associate professor in the Department of Human Development and Family Sciences at East Carolina University. Dr. Hedge primarily works with pre-service and in-service teachers in the birth through kindergarten program. Her formative background is in human development and family studies with a specialization in early childhood care and education. Over the years, Dr. Hedge has worked on several interdisciplinary projects with faculty in the Department of Nutrition, Departments of Nutrition, Engineering, and Social Work. She is known for her work in teacher education and teacher professional training. Tammy Lee is an Associate Professor of Science Education for the Department of Mathematics, Science, and Industrial Technology Education at East Carolina University. Dr. Lee's research focuses on the identity development of formal and informal educators and global education addressing climate change, as well as investigating systems thinking teaching practices using visual models and modeling. Dr. Lee has extensive experience working with large-scale research and professional development projects. She is also known for her work within the field of elementary science education development. I want to thank them for being here today. If people have questions throughout the presentation, please type those in the Q&A box, and I'll moderate those to our presenters at the end. At this point, I can hand it over to our presenters.
Thank you. I'll get us started. Jocelyn and I will do the primary presentation, and then we've got our whole panel to address questions. So Dr. Hege is our early childhood expert, and Dr. Lee in science education, and they were critical to this project. I also want to recognize the larger team. This is a huge team that came together. These are just the individuals listed on the paper that we're discussing today. So Jessica Rezor, who is with East Carolina University but lives in Ohio, is critical to our teacher support. Dr. Goodell, who many may be familiar with here at NC State University through her work with SNEB. Dr. Valerie McMillan at NCA&T, also an early childhood expert. Our speech language pathologist, Dr. Mendez. And we also had a student and a Head Start partner who was also very critical to seeing this work through the beginning to the end. So thank you to all of them as well. So I want to give a couple of notes on disclosures. The four individuals on this call do not have any potential or actual conflicts, but we did want to recognize our funding, which is through the National Institutes of Health, National Institute of General Medical Sciences, NIGMS, I think I got that time, it's a mouthful. We have a Science Education Partnership Award, which is critical to making this work happen. Our educator competencies are listed, and you'll be able to see those on the slides once they're shared as well. And this brings me to our learning objectives. So today we're going to talk about the current evidence as we know it in this space, which is food-based learning. We approach it not just from learning with food in the classroom, but try to use integrative approaches. So we'll talk a little bit about that and what we've learned so far in a preschool setting. Jocelyn will come in and talk a little bit about our methods and results from the paper that was published. And then we'll conclude with some of our learning, our lessons that we've learned, but also some of the new sneak peek outcomes that were not necessarily in this paper, but that we have analyzed on child outcomes, and a peek at the study we're actually conducting right now, which is more of an outcomes quasi-experimental study with the same intervention, but a new group of teachers. Oops, I went backwards. So I have to start by giving a little bit of background on Head Start, because not everybody is familiar with Head Start or understands what it is. So Head Start is the federally funded preschool program in the U.S., and it serves children 3 to 5 and their families primarily from limited incomes. They are funded through federal grants, which is funded through DHHS, and they are in every state and territory. Nationally, they serve just under a million children. So this is a huge population of preschool-aged children. They follow what we call the program performance standards, which in our field are somewhat of a gold standard. They are really designed to help children be ready for kindergarten in the area of cognition, social, emotional, and health and nutrition, which is where we leverage quite a bit. And I also have to point out that they do have a requirement to follow CACFP. So they do enroll in that program and provide free meals and snacks, unless the Head Start is part of a school district, at which point they would fall under the Healthy Hunger Free Kids Act. But the bulk of them are working with CACFP. In North Carolina, this is a chart of our children where they fall in overweight and obesity in our Head Start programs. And as you can see, prior to the pandemic, we weren't doing too bad. We were fairly stable. The rate of obesity is still fairly high compared to the national rate. We're a few percentage points above. But once the pandemic hit and after, we saw significant increases, at least in North Carolina, probably in other states, in the rates of overweight and obesity. When children began to return to the classroom, because there was quite a bit of virtual learning happening, we did see some declines, but they seem to be tracking back upward. So there is a bit of concern in what this looks like in our Head Start children, specifically all preschool children, but definitely our Head Start children. And this is possibly related to the evidence that shows that Head Start children are more likely to be at risk when it comes to dietary quality and nutritional deficiencies. They tend to have lower intakes of fruit and vegetable consumption, which we know is a risk factor for obesity rates as well as long-term disease. A lot of this may be related to higher levels of food insecurity as well. When it comes to thinking about Head Start's goals and thinking about school readiness and getting children ready, we also know that the literature is beginning to point to an association between dietary quality and academic success across K-12. And so there's a bit of concern that we're starting with lower dietary qualities when we're trying to get children ready to enter that kindergarten classroom. Now, as I mentioned, Head Start has access to CACFP. And so in theory, there's free meals and snacks being provided that do have to meet benchmark standards with regard to provision of fruits and vegetables. But the literature has begun to show that just because a child has access to foods, particularly in this age group, does not mean that they are going to eat those foods. And so that brings us to somewhat of the foundation for the work that we're talking about today. So for those of you familiar with this developmental phase in the preschool age, we know that I don't like to call it pickiness, but that pickiness, the selective eating, begins to pick up. Typically about 18 months, we see it increase, and then it just continues to increase through those preschool years, which is when our preschool teachers would be working with these children. And we call this neophobia, or the fear of the new, and it definitely affects particularly our vegetables that have more bitter tastes. We know that children tend to like what they know and they're familiar with, as well as eat what they like. And so this brings us to this idea that more exposure to healthy foods is likely to, based on the literature, increase that child's willingness to try that food. And in fact, the literature has demonstrated this idea of repeated exposure is one of those best practices that we recommend be implemented in this setting as well as at home. Don't give up, just keep offering that food, even when you get pushback, and offer it in different ways, different forms. It's important that the children continue to see that and they see those adults around them role model the consumption of that food as well. So this is all based on the theory of mere exposure. For those of you that aren't familiar with this space, which basically says the more you're exposed to a food or anything, that you're going to begin to like it more. So we like to talk a lot about, we're getting to summer, that summer song. I don't know what it's going to be yet, but there's always this really annoying song that becomes the song of the summer, and it's played over and over and over again. And it's usually something that most of us are going to hate initially, but often by the end of the summer, you're singing it, you know, all the words. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that we've heard it and we've been desensitized, and now we've seen this song and we've heard it in all these different locations all summer. And now we know all the words, even though we started out despising that song. This same kind of concept works when we are introducing foods to children. And so the more we can introduce those foods, the more likely those children are going to like to consume those foods long term. At least this is the theory. Many of you might have heard of the 8 to 12 exposure rule, which basically says that it takes about 8 to 12 exposures before a child is going to potentially shift their preferences towards liking that food and being willing to eat it more long term. But there's some caveats to this literature. One, we know that children that are neurodiverse or have developmental disabilities are actually probably going to require higher levels of exposures. I've seen numbers as high as 30, which is a big number. We also know that a lot of this literature is based on fruits and vegetables that are novel. So one study Leanne Birch did with red peppers, foods that children don't frequently eat. And so we're basing this off of exposure to new foods with sort of a clean slate. But what we're not as sure about is how long does it take to shift a preference for a food that a child has had an unknown of exposures to, especially if those exposures were not positive. And so this 8 to 12 number is kind of out there, this rule of thumb, but there's still a lot that we don't know. What I can tell you is that when families have higher levels of food insecurity and we're telling them that they need to keep offering a food potentially 15 times before their child is going to like it, they're not going to be too keen to do that if they're concerned about food waste. And so we need to really be aware that when we're making these recommendations, in our heart, we have good intentions, but that actually means something very different to a family who is struggling to put food on the table. Their concern is mostly going to be a full belly, not that I've offered peas now for the fifth time and they've thrown it back at me. It's going to be a challenge for you to get that done. But what we do know is that nutrition education at the school setting can be a partner in this. And so we definitely recommend that we think about the school setting as actually a more important and potentially viable setting to beef up the exposures that children are having through nutrition education, not just through the meals being put on the table. The other thing is we know that our teachers, through qualitative work, have really demonstrated that they believe that they play a critical role in this. So we've had a colleague that have done a qualitative study here with Head Start teachers, and teachers actually call themselves parents at school. So teachers really do view their role as being critical to helping that child develop and grow and be ready for the next step in their academic learning. So what is food-based learning after all? Basically, it's really any classroom method with the goal of trying to improve children's willingness to try and consume healthy foods. And in some cases, it's also connecting it back to other learning standards, as we'll talk about. So this could be inside the mealtime, which tends to be the most frequent way this happens, at snack time or during an actual lunch meal. It could be outside of the mealtime where this might happen as part of learning. So it may not actually involve any real food, but it could involve stories or other learning experiences that expose them to those foods in different ways. Or it could actually be a learning experience, as you can see here on the right-hand side, one of our kids in one of our Head Start classrooms simply exploring a spinach plant. There's no pressure to eat this food. But what we're encouraging this child to do is use all the other senses in that moment to explore the different parts of that food with a different lens. We're not talking about this being a healthy food. We're talking about this as being a living thing. So food-based learning really crosses quite a bit of the gambit when we think about that. But there's caveats because, you know, we're asking teachers to bring food into the classroom, and there's quite a number of challenges to this. Our qualitative studies across North Carolina have shown training has been an issue. There's really little training that's actually provided to support teachers in how to integrate learning, but much less how to produce healthy foods for their classroom and then offer it in ways that are going to help support children's preferences. We know resources can always be a problem for early childhood classrooms. Policies are an interesting issue, not so much that there's a policy against food in the classroom, but that there's so many different layers of policies that teachers get nervous and overwhelmed and just decide they're not going to do anything. There's this moment of freezing where, you know, maybe they'll hear a common food policy is no outside food, which has the intention of don't bring unhealthy foods into the preschool. So you're modeling unhealthy foods like the Bojangles that you brought in for breakfast. That's the intention of that policy. But our teachers who are less really familiar with all of these policies will actually blanket that policy and say no foods, even if it's healthy, nothing from the outside. And then, of course, time is always a concern in a classroom setting. There's never enough time to do all of the things that we want teachers to do. And so really from our qualitative work in North Carolina years ago, this idea of integrating these concepts in the preschool classroom is where this came about. So clearly, as nutrition educators, we're very interested in getting more foods that are healthy in the classroom through the menus, through other experiences, because we know of the benefits of repeated exposure and creating positive mealtime environments. But from the lens of an early childhood teacher, really any classroom teacher, their goal as an educator is to help those children meet whatever goals they're going to have to meet towards the end of the year. And so in this case, in preschool, we're thinking about growth and development, cognition, social, emotional, really getting them ready for that kindergarten classroom as the next step. But there's nothing saying that you can't integrate some of these healthy ideas, food-based learning, for example, into math, science, literacy. And in fact, it's not overly complicated when we're talking about the young classroom. It could be as simple as integrating a healthy food, but exploring it with science tools instead of expecting a child to eat it for the snack. It could be as simple as thinking about counting or grouping or comparing or contrasting. And weirdly, what we find is if we give children those opportunities to explore those foods in those environments where there's low pressure, they tend to want to try it by themselves naturally. We don't even have to ask. So the emphasis being on these other things that we know they need to learn naturally kind of helps them connect to this idea that, well, this is a food that I might want to try because they're not feeling that same level of pressure. But again, back to what we know about our teachers, they need more support. So a recent study we published in JNEB last year really demonstrated that there's this connection that teachers see between school readiness and food, but getting there is a whole different ballgame. They're not necessarily understanding exactly what types of food they should integrate. They're not always understanding how integration can happen in a way that not only exposes kids to healthy foods, but also teaches a scientific concept. So one example that we like to give, which was actually an example that came out of interviews as well, but if you want to teach a science concept, for example, about composting, you know, you're talking about vermiculture and potentially creating a compost bin and looking at worms as a living thing, et cetera. Well, often we would find teachers doing things on the food side, like creating, you know, that Oreo cup dessert thing where then they get gummy worms and the worms are the worms in the dirt that was made from Oreos. Not exactly what we're intending with food-based learning when we're thinking about exposing children to healthy foods. Now, the flip side of that is sometimes we'll have teachers create things with healthy foods, like a butterfly. We're going to learn about the butterfly cycle. So I'm going to create a little butterfly out of some pretzels and apples or different things like that. So great, now we have healthier foods, but that doesn't actually really teach the child anything about the life cycle of a butterfly. So there's this challenge really to think about connecting those healthy foods in a way that will also result in an actual learning outcome versus these loosely connected pieces. And that's where teachers really need some support. And our team sometimes struggles with it. It takes a team to kind of get there, but there are ways to get there and teach teachers how to get there. So before we jump into our new study, I did want to sort of allude to this idea that we have tested and published a pilot study several years ago where we were looking at, okay, the goal with food-based learning is to integrate food-based learning with academic learning domains like science or math. But does that actually do anything with children's dietary quality, which is our goal at the end of the day? And in this preliminary pilot study back in 2018, we did find that if we go in and we integrate these science-based food learning experiences that we can have some effect on children's dietary quality. So in this particular study, we were able to achieve stability. So what we commonly see in our Head Start sites is we'll start school at a similar place, but when they go home for break, there's a significant drop off in their dietary quality, and they almost never recover from that drop off that occurs, even when they come back and they're there for a full spring. In this intervention, what we found is we were able to get children to maintain that dietary quality versus observing that significant drop off. Now, there's a couple catches here. The first one is access. We did nothing to shift access. So the theory is that exposure to those healthier foods more consistently encouraged them to eat those foods when they were available. And it also pointed to the need for us to do something with access paired with the education long-term, which is something we're currently working on in our study that's operating right now. The second piece of this is we delivered these experiences. We were the ones going into the classrooms, being the teacher for the teacher, and that's not sustainable. And so the first question that we really wanted to tackle was this idea is, can we train teachers to do food-based learning in an integrative way that's just as effective as we were going to go in the classroom? And in fact, probably more effective because they have a lot more experience in child development and the learning outcomes they're trying to achieve. And so that is the goal that we really worked on with this particular gym that is featured for today's webinar. So it brings me to our gym, More Peas Please, teaching teachers how to integrate food-based learning in the preschool classroom. And really what we were most interested in this second pilot, I guess you could say pilot with the teachers as the implementers, was what were those issues that they ran into, the barriers, the supports, the overall experiences, and engaging in a program where we go in and we train them how to do this, and then we support them through that process and measure that process. And so the program we're talking about is PEAS, or Preschool Education and Applied Sciences. And this is a multi-component intervention that this team on the call designed over a period of several years. That really was designed to improve children's early science learning while we were also making an impact on their dietary quality. And we approached this from an angle of supporting changes in teachers' instructional practices. So what we didn't want to do is hand off a curriculum. If you know anything about the early childhood setting, best practice really is following children's interests, so child-led learning. And so if we were to walk in and say, here's a curriculum, that kind of goes against best practice. And honestly, it's not sustainable long-term, because what happens when they get tired of the curriculum? Well, then you got to develop another curriculum. Instead, what we wanted to do is provide teachers with a series of instructional practices that they could learn to implement so that eventually they would have enough efficacy to identify something of interest and begin to do that integration best practice independently based on children's learning. And we're working on getting there. That's a long road. It's not as simple as it sounds, if it sounds simple at all. But long-term, that is our goal. And so our outcomes are really, again, focused on shifting that classroom practice, which hopefully will lead to improved confidence in teachers to implement science learning in the classroom with this integrative food-based learning approach. From the child side, our goal is those outcomes related to what they need to do from kindergarten readiness. So we wanted to improve science knowledge. We wanted to change their language development in positive ways. And we wanted to work on dietary quality at the same time, with the understanding that all of this would lead to better kindergarten readiness in the long run. Some insight into those strategies that I've mentioned are demonstrated here on this wheel. So we spent a couple of years as a team really digging in the evidence-based literature and thinking about the interconnections between the preschool classroom and the K-12 setting. So we developed a series of strategies, and I won't dive too deep, but I'm more than happy to talk with anyone about these, and so are educators here on the call. But we developed basically strategies that would fit in each one of these buckets. So practice science, and I'll give an example of this in a couple of slides, was really the one that connected strongly to the next generation science standards. So those pick up in kindergarten, and these are the science standard that's going to guide children's learning really all the way through 12th grade. And so we were really strongly believed in helping prepare those preschool teachers with an understanding of what that looked like and how can you apply that in developmentally appropriate ways in that preschool classroom. And then we have a series of other strategies, engage the senses, which is really where a lot of our food-based best practices, like repeated exposure, using your five senses, best practices around food-based learning come into play. We built language through science talk and then developmentally appropriate teaching practices through support learning. More information is in that paper, but also on our website. So an example really quick of the practice science strategies, each one of these areas just has three to try to keep it fairly simple. But we really emphasize the process of science. So often preschool teachers like to pick up quick, cool activities that they found on Pinterest. And it makes a really interesting activity. It's usually something that explodes or changes color or something that's super interesting for a four-year-old. And I get it. You want to keep their attention. But the problem is it doesn't teach children how to actually go through the process of science like scientists do. How do we ask questions? How do we explore? How do we learn more about that thing that we're studying? And so we train teachers on how to think more like this cycle than just one quick activity that doesn't lead to long-term learning. We think about the big ideas, which are cross-cutting concepts for those familiar with NGSS. So things like compare and contrast, structure and function, cause and effect. And we think about using tools in the classroom. So these would be measuring, observing like children are doing here, or even using communication tools like beginning early stages of writing, verbal communication, or the other measurement, those types of things. This is just a quick slide that shows an example unit. So while we teach teachers practices, when you're learning a new practice, it's helpful to have something that you can practice with. And so we do have some model learning activities that we use for teachers to get started in the classroom as they're beginning to learn these practices, but they're not intended to be a long-term curriculum. So this is just living, non-living, which is a really important concept for those that have ever had children in a kindergarten classroom. This has probably come up. So it gives children sort of that step up for the next step. But again, it walks teachers through that cycle and touches on those different strategies and really actually gives them the words to say as they're learning to develop these strategies in their classroom. So when we think about the full intervention, we actually have, I mentioned multi-level, there are four different components that are really key to a successful implementation of PEAS. And Jocelyn will talk about which one of these teachers really felt like were most critical in a few slides. But first we start with our Kickstarter workshop. You can see Dr. Hege there in the picture with our teachers. But our Kickstarter workshop is really critical because this is where we get to know our teachers. We go in person. It's usually most of the day. And I pull Dr. Lee out in front of them because she's our amazing science educator and she engages everybody. She's incredible. So basically we all come together for this day and we teach them about the different practices, but they do a lot of hands-on learning too, to get familiar with what it is that we're going to be doing in the classroom. It also helps us connect with each of those teachers and understand where they are and what kind of supports they're going to need as the classroom, as the year moves on. We do have online training modules. These are on-demand modules that teachers will work through the course of the year. There's typically 5 to 6, depending on the goals of that particular group of teachers. I think this particular study had 6. And teachers basically go through each of those modules. And one of the neat things about the modules is it really reviews each of those spaces and gives them more time to concentrate in on what it is they're going to be teaching in the classroom, particularly in the space of the strategies. But each of those little teaching strategies has like a 3 to 5 minute whiteboard training video. So they can get a quick review of what it is we're asking them to do and how that might play out. And then we also have videos that pair with each of those model learning experiences so they can see how that unit is going to play out in the classroom, what materials they need. And it even reviews some light science content that they might not feel as comfortable with before they go into the classroom and begin implementing those activities. This down here on the left-hand corner is our teaching guide, which is where you would find, again, a written overview of those teaching strategies and then the model learning activities. And the unique part of the model learning activities is it is word for word what to do in the classroom. Our intention is not that teachers have the book and they're reading off what to do while their children are in the circle time. Not at all. But what it does is actually give them ideas for prompts. If we're thinking about open-ended questions, if we're thinking about how to get a child to talk about something they're observing, these scripts really give teachers the words to help them feel confident in what I need to do and what I could possibly say in that situation. And you can see some of the pictures here of our kids doing different activities in their classroom. This one down here is a little hard to see, but he's holding up a little binder. This is one of my favorites. He was doing an activity with plants and they were learning about the needs of plants, which just happened to be a vegetable plant. And he drew what he observed and what he had learned about the needs of a plant. So these little lines off to the left are actually rain droplets. And towards the bottom, it's harder to see, but there's a sun. And so he was documenting what he was observing with those leaves in that plant. And then what are the things that he learned they needed? They actually did some experimentation in the classroom where they had no light, light, water, no water, different trials with those plants. Down here, this little kid with the magnifying glass, and I'll show here in a second a larger slide, we also provide them with all the materials that they need in their classroom to make sure that they're able to move forward effectively. And then finally, we have a couple of environmental supports that are really critical. In addition to individualized one-on-one technical support that happens on the site, we also set up what we call learning communities where teachers have a guide that help guide them through the process of implementing this work in their classroom. But really, it's to get them to talk to each other and learn from each other as they're implementing and have conversations about what they're seeing children learn. And then again, we work on some of the menus. So with regards to the menu, we utilize the Knapsack tool to actually work with the nutrition manager who's responsible for the menus across that program. And we improve not just the quality of fruits and vegetables, but also make sure that the fruits and vegetables that show up in the classroom intervention show up on the menu. So it's another way for us to ensure that one, the menu improves, so access potentially improves from that angle, but that they're also getting that repeated exposure through fruits and vegetables that would have shown up in the classroom. And you can reference back to this slide, but it's a list of some of the resources that teachers will receive. So I'm going to pass it off to Jocelyn to talk a little bit about the study design.
Great. So the design for this study was a pre-post test design with one group, and we were looking to assess the feasibility and acceptability among Head Start teachers and administrators through both summative and formative evaluations. And as Virginia talked about, the intervention was starting in August of 2021. So important to note for a later discussion, this is pretty soon after the pandemic is still going on and very much in swing. And so that kickoff workshop occurred in August, and then the intervention concluded at the end of the school year in May 2022. And off to the right-hand side, you can see we were working in three different counties in eastern North Carolina, two of which were rural counties. And in those three counties, we had four Head Start centers that had 24 Head Start teachers who were trained at that initial August 2021 kickoff workshop. And these teachers went through the PEAS professional development program, as Virginia described in those four quadrants, the different components that they were engaged with. And as part of the PEAS program, those model science learning activities, we had around 400 children across those four Head Start centers who were participating in those model learning activities. So each of the units, the PEAS units, each had four activities associated with them, which is how we got to that 16 number. So specifically, all the surveys, both formative and summative, were administered using REDCap, which if you're not familiar, is a really great HIPAA-compliant web-based program that allows us to administer surveys and also manage the data on the back end. And teachers completed a formative evaluation or a formative survey after each module. And these evaluations were super short, about 5 minutes to complete, and asked about feedback that was specific to the module they just completed. So asked questions about the difficulties that they may have experienced, the supports they may have experienced, how many of those four learning activities they were able to implement, and general feedback sort of specific to each module. And then we also had them complete at the end of the program. So that would be at the end of April and May 2022, a summative evaluation that was a bit longer, about 20 minutes to complete, and looked more at the bigger picture, asking them to rate the helpfulness of the intervention, of the resources, and to tell us sort of how did PEAS potentially impact the practices that you do in the classroom related to integrated food-based learning. At the end of that summative evaluation, we invited teachers to participate in an optional telephone interview where we asked them further questions that related to their responses in the summative evaluation. And this interview was optional for teachers. And just as a note, all of our instruments were tested for face and content validity with additional information on that in the GEM. So teachers were compensated for their time. They received a reloadable MasterCard gift card that was loaded after they completed formative and summative evaluations, which they could earn up to $120. They were also given funds for their learning community to support in the center, as well as for teachers who completed the entire program from start to finish, were given 3 continuing education units, which in North Carolina can be used towards their licensure as a early child educator. And then for the child, children had exposure to high quality science experiences, as Virginia talked about, really learning, okay, how do I do the process of science versus these one and done explosion activities, right? How do I actually build upon and create a science experiment that's developmentally appropriate? So children got to experience that to develop academic language and vocabulary around those activities. And also, as dietitians, what we're really excited about is having hands-on exposure to healthy foods in non-pressuring environments. So the data analysis piece of the GEM, so the quantitative data, we use descriptive statistics and frequencies, and the qualitative data was analyzed using phenomenology or common lived experiences. And those interviews, as I mentioned, were optional, and they were conducted by a trained researcher on our team. And they were recorded, transcribed verbatim, and then open coded among 2 researchers until 100% consensus was reached. And those are some of our kiddos from PEAS. They're so cute. So our participants, we had 24, as I said, who participated in the PEAS program in this pilot. They were female, around 46 years old, primarily Black or African-American, non-Hispanic, with either an associate's degree or a bachelor's degree. And 83% of participants, or 19 out of those 24 participants, completed all the modules, including all formative and summative surveys. And the remaining 5, or 17%, completed at least one module and at least one formative survey going along with the module that they completed. So looking overall kind of at the big takeaways from those formative assessments that, again, teachers were completing after they finished a module, was the biggest challenge was lack of time in the daily classroom schedule for the PEAS activities. And this is something we'll talk about in a minute as well, so sort of put a bookmark on that comment. And then the biggest support was children's interest and enthusiasm in PEAS topics. You can see in the pictures below, children really engaged in the concepts of science that the model learning activities we're trying to teach. Looking at the bigger picture questions that were asked teachers in the summative evaluation, teachers told us that the most helpful PEAS resources were the whiteboard teaching videos that you can see a snippet of below that outlined and helped teachers understand those best practices that we're trying to teach through the PEAS strategies, as well as the PEAS teaching guide, which was a written resource that had both the activities as well as outlines of each of those strategies as well. The least helpful PEAS resource was the on-demand learning platform, which I think anyone in our team could vouch was likely for many reasons. One being Eastern North Carolina, the Wi-Fi service and reception is generally terrible. So we experienced a lot of issues, even with bringing in outside hotspots, of just getting connectivity in the centers. The second thing would just be teachers' familiarity and comfortability with navigating online platforms. A lot of our teachers may be used to more paper-based methods, and so this was not a surprise that this was the least favorite, least helpful piece of PEAS. Switching to the most valuable, teachers really valued the science kit materials for their classroom. As Virginia mentioned, these had things like microscopes and petri dishes and pipettes, had seeds and all different things that teachers could utilize both as part of PE activities, but also to incorporate into common places in the classroom like centers and circle time. Teachers also valued the gift cards that they were given and access to healthy foods for these science activities. So this would be an example. You can find all of our YouTube videos, all of the whiteboard videos on our YouTube channel. You can see there at More Peas, Please. So looking at the summative results, continuing, all teachers indicated that they were likely or highly likely to continue to use the PE strategies in their classroom even after completing the program. And so the engage the senses, which is really what we're talking about with repeated exposures and incorporating culturally appropriate healthy foods into the classroom, teachers really valued that in the apply science talk strategies a little bit more than they did the practice science and support learning strategies. And you can see there highly likely versus likely. And then all teachers rated their overall PEAS experience as excellent or good. And about 83% were likely or highly likely to recommend PEAS to another teacher. And as I alluded to before, 77% of our teachers preferred to complete the modules on paper versus online due to those challenges. This is one of my favorite slides in the presentations because all teachers agreed or strongly agreed that PEAS positively impacted their ability to provide engaging science using healthy foods. And so as dietitians, we're excited about the ability to use healthy foods in a way that can impact preference and consumption in a way that's fun and non-pressuring outside the mealtime environment. But particularly why I love this slide is just getting to work so closely with each of these amazing educators and getting to watch them transform classroom practices. These pictures were taken at the end of the program with their completion certificates, and it was wonderful to get to work alongside such an incredible Head Start team. So switching gears a little bit, so we've talked about results from the formative assessments, talked a little bit about the results from the summative assessments, and so the qualitative, those phone calls that were conducted. So this is really interesting because we were hearing, as I mentioned in the formative assessments, that teachers were saying time is a barrier for me to be incorporating the PEAS practices and these model science learning activities into the classroom. But when we actually got to talk to teachers about it in a conversation, we learned that initially time was a barrier for teachers, but as they became more familiar with the PEAS program, that barrier decreased and it became less of a challenge over time. Secondly, we saw that teachers were motivated by children's enthusiasm for science and excitement for trying new foods that they may not have identified prior to beginning the program. They might not have said prior to working with PEAS that, yes, my children in my classroom are excited for science learning and for engaging with healthy foods outside the mealtime environment. Thirdly, teachers desired an increase in the variety of foods presented. So the original activities, all the activities had the ability to taste the foods so that healthy foods were not wasted or thrown away or manipulated in ways that were no longer edible. And we really focused on four vegetables: carrots, peas, tomatoes, and spinach. And as Virginia alluded to in one of those background slides, a lot of the studies have really talked about the foods that are novel that children may not have experiences with. But when we're thinking about Head Start populations, we really want to think about the foods that they're going to have access to both at school and in the home. And so that was the reasoning behind why we chose these initial four vegetables. And going off of that, we chose a small number of vegetables to hope that we could increase exposure to those vegetables as much as we could throughout the length of the program. Nonetheless, teachers were very excited to tell us that they would love to see more vegetables and potentially fruits in the program going forward. One of the teachers was like, "I'm getting tired of carrots. If I see carrots more time," we're like, "Okay, noted." So we'll talk a little bit about how that impacted the program in the future and kind of our questions about that as dietitians and researchers. Fourthly, teachers were surprised at children's science retention and abilities. And I think this is really interesting. And I've loved getting to work alongside people on our team like Dr. Lee, who've kind of opened my eyes to the ability of young individuals to flourish in the science realm. And so teachers were like, I didn't even know that at this level they could comprehend these kinds of concepts. And so this was a really neat takeaway that we got from the qualitative work that we did. Next piece, technical support was key to their success. I'll mention that again in a minute. And COVID-19 negatively affected their engagement. So we like to bring this up whenever we talk about the pilot study. Again, as I mentioned earlier, we are in 2021 and 2022, where COVID is still very much a part of everyday lives. And so if there was a positive test in a classroom, whether it be a teacher or a child, that classroom would be out for 2 weeks. And so that significantly impacted some of the PEAS engagement. And then lastly, PEAS became a model for learning and implementation, such that teachers were learning about the PEAS practices, they were practicing in the classroom, they were reflecting on what they saw and what they were engaged in, which then motivated them to want to learn more. So it became this continual cycle. So as I mentioned, the technical support teachers mentioned is critical. And so we built in, moving into our quasi-experimental year, a more official role for a PEAS coach. And you can see her in the middle there, Sharonda. She's wonderful. She gets to meet with teachers one-on-one before each module to discuss expectations of the module, set goals, support, troubleshoot, in a much more official and formalized role than was provided in the pilot. We've also created a wonderful teacher board of 5 teachers from the pilot who were really forerunners and cheerleaders and innovative in their use of PEAS. And so they work with us. We meet with them once or twice a year in person. And then they also work with us year round to review any programmatic changes or suggestions that we have to the PEAS program, as well as to re-implement activities and provide us their expertise on what they want to see in the program, which is one of my favorite things of getting to be a part of this team, is working with these incredible, incredible educators. And they're going, we're going to be moving into their 4th year with us, which is just amazing. One of the biggest things that they've really helped us to develop, which did not exist in the pilot, are these amazing new resources that are available. So the first being that science journal. Virginia alluded to the drawing that a child did of the basil plant. And now we have developed an official science journal that has a developmentally appropriate area for a drawing, as well as writing beneath. And then we've incorporated actual living things into our living things unit, which you can see that child there is very excited about the worm that they're holding, and a worm farm to convert that to a classroom pet. And then the erasable documentation and prediction panels, which you can see sported by our teachers this year, which are both environmentally friendly, but also great for teachers to be able to display in the classroom. We developed pictorial dictionaries with words like experiment, hypothesis, documentation, or seed coat that have a colorful picture on one side, and then a child-friendly definition for teachers to use to explain more difficult concepts or higher-level words to children. And then one of my personal favorite are the child-friendly knives that we've started to include in the kits based on teachers' recommendation for wanting children to have more hands-on in the tasting, the preparations of the tasting, and also developing fine motor skills when we're working in the food-based learning realm. I'll turn it back to Virginia for these last few implications.
So Jocelyn mentioned this idea of more variety from our teachers. So we actually did integrate more variety in the fruits and vegetables, but we also turned one of the last activities as part of a unit into more of a recipe-based cooking type activity. So in our last set of learning experiences, we try to get teachers to think about how they can bring all those things together and experience a recipe of some sort, but do it in a way that children can engage in that preparation. And so through that, we've created recipes that were tested in the classroom. Our teacher board actually tested those before we started implementing them, that can pull together those different fruits and vegetables that show up in a new way to expose children. And they are aligned with CACFP. There's a map on our website that kind of aligns all of the foods across the curriculum, but especially these recipes, so that they could be incorporated into CACFP if needed. We have also brought in more gardening experiences. So the bulk of our sort of curriculum is based on the life sciences, which is a disciplinary core area in NGSS. And so we look a lot at growing foods, healthy foods, plants, how to grow plants, seeds, those types of concepts. And so we've begun supplying classrooms with support from our SNAP-Ed program with portable gardens. So the beauty of these gardens, one is we can go out and have them actually plant and grow things outside, not just always inside. But the beauty of these is they can be emptied. So Head Start classrooms follow the traditional school year. They don't go all year like a lot of preschools do. And so there's a need, one, to be able to plant things that can grow quickly before children leave in May to harvest, but then also to be able to store these things so they're not sitting out over the summer months. And so you can see this is something we actually started planting in February. I think this picture was taken a couple weeks ago, and they're already starting to sprout, and we have students as one of our kind of extension arms going out and helping support those learning activities. Libby here is fantastic with her little green thumb. Back to where we were. And I'm going to pass discussion and conclusion back to Jocelyn.
So to kind of conclude all of these things, so integrating food-based learning into other school readiness domains can really address a lot of the barriers that teachers have talked about, whether that be priority or policy or whatever it may be. As we already talked about, teachers may prefer more variety in the healthy foods that are featured in interventions, which is what we have tried to incorporate into the PEAS program and will continue to do so. That being said, future research is really needed to understand this idea of exposure and its impact, and specifically about the difference of a variety of vegetables versus a single vegetable and how that can have an impact on preference and consumption in the preschool population.
And so, just a quick, just a quick sneak peek, and then we'll wrap it up. Our current study that we published is the gym really looked at some of those very preliminary outcomes, and we're beginning to publish more in-depth analysis of the qualitative interviews, for example, child outcomes. We recently submitted these outcomes for SNEB this summer, so hopefully we have a poster, come check us out. But we were able to analyze outcomes on child learning as well as dietary quality. And we have found using the Vegemeters, our skin carotenoid measurement, that we were able to impact dietary quality. Science knowledge did improve significantly over the year, and so did our academic vocabulary. And so it looks like, preliminary in our pilot, that we're having positive effects on both children's learning as well as their dietary quality, which is our goal. And this year, we're currently working on more, as Jocelyn said, the quasi-experimental studies. So we'll have control groups as well as our comparison groups, as well as our intervention groups, and we'll really be able to tease out those effects across a program. And we're really excited to see how those go. So thank you for having us, and we're open to questions.
Thank you so much. As people have questions, please post those in the Q&A box. So one question that came in Head Start, is there no domain on nutrition and health? And is that why you tried to work with the life sciences?
So they do have a domain that could cover that nutrition health area. Really, the life sciences, though, was what we selected because it tends to be a common space for early learning. There's a lot of foundation in the life sciences. Children already have experience quite often with plants growing outside, with foods in their home environment as well at school. And so that foundation was already there to build. If you think about constructivism or building on a foundation that already exists, that was the primary reason. But there are other domains that could be taught. So physical science has been one we've talked about, earth science. These are other spaces that we've actually done a mapping. I think we have it on our website, from NGSS to more preschool friendly spaces across those domains. But for us, life science has just made sense because of that growing piece. Farm to ECE, for example, is a big thing. Those connections were so natural across the board. But there is an attempt to talk about healthy eating and make those connections in the classroom. It's just there's not a whole lot of attempt to make those connections to those other learning domains.
That makes sense. Thank you for sharing that. How did you develop the whiteboard teaching videos?
Oh, this is an interesting process. That process took a couple of years. I taught a nutrition education course years ago, and I had a assessment or a sort of a project that I had my students do where they had to figure out how to deliver their education in a really inventive way. And I ended up having a student who's very skilled in creating these whiteboards. In theory, anyone could do them because we did it from almost no funding, because we did not write that in the original grant. It was something that came out as being needed through our initial assessments. And so we just got the resources. We got a whiteboard. We got some markers. We happened to recruit a student who could draw. And then our team wrote all of the scripting and did the storyboards together in a collaborative way. So we would kind of draft the initial things and I'd send it off to Tammy, Dr. Lee, and say, hey, can you look at this from the angle of science talk? Please weave in some language, or can you think of an idea or a storyline that can be woven in? So it was a very integrative approach. But then we had a student who could do the drawings themselves. And so she was very artistic. But really, if you find any artistic student or hire somebody that has those skills, you could put these together with, gosh, a shoestring budget. Wasn't difficult. Whiteboard markers. I think she did some paintings in a couple places, but yeah.
Nice. Well, I want to thank you so much. We are running out of time. Yeah. So at this point I need to pass it back to Paul, but I thank you again for a great presentation. It was wonderful to learn about this project.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you to Kristen and thank you to all of our panelists here today. We appreciate you being here. I just have a few reminders before I close out the session. One, again, please complete the survey that you'll receive when the session ends. Your feedback is greatly appreciated. Be on the lookout for that email with today's recording, the handouts, and your CEU certificate. And if you enjoyed today's webinar, be sure to check out the upcoming webinar section of the SNEB website. Journal Club continues next Monday. And with that, that brings us to the end of today's session. Thank you for joining us and have a great day.